You've dedicated your life to helping others, but what about living the life you want for yourself? This is the A Life Well Lived, A Physician's Guide to Wealth podcast. I'm James Nutter from I Am Wealth, and I will be your host and guide throughout this epic journey together. I'm here to help you take control of your money so you can live a purposeful life without wasting any of your precious time.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of A Life Well Lived, A Physician's Guide to Wealth. Today, we have an awesome episode. We're talking about one of the biggest financial moves physicians make, buying or selling real estate, and what the heck has been going on in the real estate market since COVID. It's hot, it's cold, it's hot, it's cold. Interest rates are up, down, left, right. What is happening, right? So whether you're relocating for a new attending job, trying to build equity instead of renting, or even thinking about investing in property, real estate can either build wealth or it can drain it fast. You all know the physician who has the biggest mansion in the community, and they might potentially be living paycheck to paycheck, right? So my guest today is Zoe Taylor, a top realtor, relocation specialist, and founder of Moving Medicine Partners, a nationwide network built to help physicians and medical families navigate moves, purchases, and investments the right way. They currently have 83 realtors, and I believe every single one is married to a physician. So very, very, very unique company. And a special shout out to Dr. Tammy Krause from Financial Residency. I actually met Zoe through her in the Physician Finance Facebook group. Now, Zoe is based in St. Louis. She has deep ties to the medical community and has helped hundreds of physicians, residents, and medical professionals make smarter real estate decisions that align with their careers and lifestyle. She brings years of experience running medical offices and now channels that same worth ethic and empathy into real estate. In this episode, we dive into the biggest mistakes physicians make when buying a home, how to know if now is the right time to buy or sell, and what the outlook for the 2026 real estate market really looks like. We'll also unpack the myth that real estate is passive income and no work. And Zoe will share what actually works for busy doctors who want to build wealth through real estate without burning out. And because your health is your wealth, and that's one of my favorite segments of the show, because none of us are anything without our health, Zoe opens up about the other daily habits and non-negotiables that has kept her grounded as a business owner and what she does when she feels that edge of burnout creeping in. This conversation is part real estate playbook, part mindset reset, and it's one every physician should hear before making their next big move. Without further ado, welcome to the show, Zoe Taylor. Zoe, so let's just start big right out of the gate, right? What's the number one mistake you see physicians make when buying real estate right now?
I mean, sometimes it depends on the stage of their training. I see residents coming in my market, they can still afford to buy here in St. Louis. And sometimes they're wanting these like Pinterest perfect homes. They want homes that are being sold for too much money because they have board and batten walls and a good paint job. And there might be a house down the street that's in, you know, like not as beautiful condition, but structurally and the foundational things are perfect. And it would be very suitable to get them through training, maybe a minor amount of sweat equity needed, and they're overpaying for pretty houses. And I try to educate them and steer them away from that. Attendings, I find, you know, first position is typically not their forever position. And so they overbuy or just feel like they're going to be in that home for much longer than they end up being. I think that the statistics say that they're in their first position for less than 5 years typically. And so they're buying this house that they swear is going to be the forever home. And I'm like, okay, look at the stats. It probably isn't. And I typically hear from them within a couple of years, like, hey, this isn't fitting us because of the neighborhood or for this reason or that reason. So they just don't future plan as well as I feel like maybe they could or should. So really trying to help them map out, you know, what's your future look like in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, house-wise, how does that fit? Or are you okay with switching that up in the future? So it depends on their stage of life. The Pinterest homes get me though. Like, don't buy it because it's pretty. Like, that can change.
Do you feel like, you know, because I'm sure my generation, me being a millennial, like we definitely fall into that trap all the time, like buy it because it's pretty. Or do you think like the onset of social media and like having everything at our fingertips, like Zillow and everything, is probably like a cause of that as well? The comparison culture as well.
Instagram, Pinterest, Zillow, all of the above probably contribute towards really leaning towards those beautiful homes. But it's like, okay, if you're spending $50,000 more on this house just for a good paint job, like buy the house down the street, put a few hundred dollars into painting and voila, you have instant equity. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And so many new attendings like feel maybe like pressure right away to buy, even maybe physicians in training too. And there can be some good opportunity, right? Maybe you live in an area near a hospital and you buy in training and then you can rent it out. We have a few IM Wealth members that are doing that when they become attendings and move to a different city. Why is that often sometimes like a new attending feeling pressure to buy right away could be potentially like the worst financial move they could make?
I think it's just pent up ability to spend, you know, living off of debt for years and years. Their goal, you know, I feel like they always have this goal. It gets better, IGB, or like done with training, DWT is like this phrase and mantra that a lot of physician spouses have. And part of that goal with that mantra is finally being able to have a house, finally being able to upgrade their car because they're typically running on an older vehicle that's on its last leg, being able to live in a neighborhood that they've been idolizing for whatever amount of time. So I think that they have been patient for a very long time, living off of little income and a lot of debt. So when they finally have that opportunity to, they're like, finally, it's here. Let's go for it. But it's like, yeah, maybe you should push pause for a couple more years, which sucks. Like, I get it. You know, you're in your 30s at this point. You've been working your butt off through training and it's obtainable at this point, but sometimes it's not the best option. You're right.
You talk about like delayed gratification, right? Like so many, yeah. And I can, as an entrepreneur, I don't have, you know, quite the student loan debt and had to like go through that burn in. I always joke, I've never worked like a 48, right? But in this like immediate gratification culture, it's probably extremely difficult to see all your friends like buying houses, traveling the world, upgrading their houses, like, you know, all the things.
Yeah.
It definitely makes total sense. And something we see too, we have some families that hire us before they get their first attending paycheck, which is a pretty unique place to hire because they typically don't have like money at that time. But you can really start to think about like, what does your ideal lifestyle look like? And then how can you actually like make a plan to bring these things to life?
Yeah, look in the future and work your way backwards. And then the other thing with that also is just like with physician loans, it's obtainable. They don't have a lot of money for down payments. Even if they just had a sign-on bonus for their first position as an attending, it's still typically not enough for like true down payment if you were using a conventional loan. Having this product available makes buying a house available to almost every new physician. And so I think that if there was more of a barrier for entry, there would be a little bit more of a delay, but there's this beautiful opportunity, which is a great opportunity for a lot of people. But I feel like that barrier, there's like not a lot of skin in the game. You know, you're buying a house and sometimes getting a check back at closing, which is crazy. If you're getting like 103% finance, which feels good in that moment for immediate gratification. I bought a house and I got a check out of it. Like that's crazy town, but it happens. I think if there was a little bit more skin in the game, maybe there would be a little bit more hesitancy or delay in that first purchase or the wrong purchase or overspending on their first home.
That makes sense. I don't get an entrepreneur loan. I wish I could.
I wish. No, if anything, it's way harder for 1099 and self-employed people to get a loan. Oh my gosh, the red tape is extreme.
What advice do you give? And I know you're not a mortgage banker, but like around physician loans, like what's kind of like your thought process for maybe like a newer attending and like how to view those or even like gathering options? Like should they talk multiple banks? Like what does that look like?
Oh gosh, yeah. Definitely multiple banks. What's crazy is if you call 10 banks, most of them will say that they have a professional loan or a physician loan. It's a non-conforming loan or portfolio loan, which most people aren't going to understand what that means. The problem is a lot of those banks, they're not better than a conventional loan. Like when I think of a physician loan, I want no money down, no PMI, interest rates at or better than true like conforming conventional loans, and no like closing cost fees that are offsetting points or something that you're buying down your rate. A lot of lenders I see have much higher interest rates where they have PMI. It's just hidden in a higher interest rate. And most physicians aren't going to know to shop for this. They're going to be like, oh, that's a physician loan rate. That's not great. Well, no, that bank's physician loan rate isn't good. When you're doing conventional lending on a conforming loan, every single lender is selling the same product across the United States on conforming loans. Whatever's being set up right now, they may have different like funding fees and lender fees, but the product itself is going to be the same from every lender. Portfolio loans or private loans, the bank is setting the terms because the bank is funding that through the entirety of the loan. So they're able to be a lot more flexible with the criteria, barrier for entry, criteria for barrier to entry, but then also the product itself. So I have some banks, and I don't want to go like too over the head, like a lot of what they'll fund is based on how many deposits they have coming into their bank. And if their deposits are running low, they'll cut off how many physician loans they want to do in a year. But instead of saying like, hey, we're not doing anymore, we'll just crank up the interest rate. So I'll have a client that applies for a lender in 1 week. And then the bank's like, oh, shoot, we need to like push the brakes on these. And then next week, another client is getting approved and the rate's 2% higher. You know what I mean? So they're constantly fluctuating. And if you don't use a realtor that really has their thumb on the pulse of what's going on with all of these different physician lenders between like Huntington and BMO and TD and, you know, the big players, but then also hyper locally, like there's a credit union here in St. Louis that has three different physician loan products. They'll even do second homes 100% financed if you want a vacation home. You don't get that many places. But if you don't know where to look, like you're just kind of randomly throwing out applications at lenders and hoping that one of them's got the best rate. So, you know, hopefully you should be working with someone who's got an idea of what's going on through all of these different agencies to be able to obtain a good loan. And yeah, definitely apply for more than one. When you're applying for a loan, as long as you apply within like a 10-day period or 14-day period, it'll only look like one credit check on your credit score. So it's not like you apply with five lenders and that's five dings on your credit score. It's only going to look like one as long as you do them all at once. And then when you've got all these applications and approvals in hand, when you finally go under contracts, you know, give them all a call. Like, hey, what are my rates today? What are your terms today? And select the lender that's going to give you the best option on the day you go under contract.
Every time I record one of these, I learn new things, and we're only like 8 minutes now. This is wonderful. I appreciate it. How do you help a physician navigate like maybe like a conventional loan versus we weren't even planning on getting into this, but how do you help them like navigate that?
It kind of depends on what their goals are. You know, I've had clients that are putting 20% down and they're like, well, because I'm putting 20% down, I'm doing a conventional loan. I'm like, honestly, it's worth looking at portfolio loans still, because oftentimes they still have better interest rates, even though you're putting 20% down, so you wouldn't be getting PMI on a conventional loan. It's worth looking into. It literally just depends on the timing of the market and what the lenders are doing with those portfolio loans in that moment and what they're doing to, you know, market them and push them forward by having those lower interest rates, or if they're pulling them back and increasing their interest rates at that time. I was actually just looking this morning at the White Coat investor page, and I don't know why, I was just like perusing what they were saying. And I didn't necessarily agree with 100% of what they were saying, because they were basically saying like physician loans are only for new doctors that don't have down payments and they don't want PMI. And then attendings are doing 20% down because they have more cash on hand. So they're doing conventional lending because the rates are better. And I was like, I don't really agree with that statement and sentiment. And then also, sometimes it's better to not put your cash into the equity of your home if you can actually be investing that money elsewhere and be accruing interest and making money on the down payment. Does that make sense? Like sometimes putting money into your home and parking it there isn't the best allocation and use of that money. So even if you are an attending, sometimes not putting that down payment down and investing that money will make more money, even though your mortgage payments are a little bit higher.
That makes total sense. And I feel like a lot of realtors I've talked to don't have that like approach, right? It's like buy more real estate, take your, you know, maybe flip a house, take proceeds, buy the net, you know, you can definitely make money doing that. But I think that's a very like wise thought process. Like if you can potentially get a higher return in the market versus mm-hmm. like what trade is, there could be, and you know, it just like depends too. A lot of times we say, what's going to make you sleep better at night? Like knowing you're putting this into your house and your monthly payment's going to go down, or knowing that you're like getting more in the market. And it just kind of depends on like, you know, it's very individualistic. And yeah, okay. White Coat Investor, like, I think they're wonderful. I've read the book. They have so many awesome resources that kind of changed the landscape of like position money. But at the same time, too, you know, kind of that, even like that mindset, like live like a resident, right? Like, we have so many clients that are like, if I live like a resident, I'm going to burn out. Like, I can't it's good. Yeah. It's really good. And Dr. Dolly, if you're listening to this, you probably aren't.
Oh, he's wonderful. I know. I love it. I've been to the White Coat Investor like national seminar several times. Like he's a brilliant guy, and who he brings together in those events is just, you learn a ton. A lot of what I know is through Jim Dolly. So I like love everything that he has to say. I just didn't agree with that piece.
There's been, you know, people might not agree with things that we say today, right? That's just kind of what makes the world go around. But I think, and another thing I've learned too, is like absorb information from different people, like, you know, that you like and trust, but you don't have to be anybody's like disciple, right? You can like gather different thoughts and processes and make your own decisions. At the end of the day, you know, gather your information, even when it's related to like a mortgage, like look at different options and then kind of make a decision of who you vibe with the best and what's going to be the best fit. And same with like different voices, whether it's White Coat Investor, this podcast. health podcast, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. If you're teaching real estate 101 for physicians, what are the, and we might've already covered some of this, what are the top three fundamentals every physician should master before buying?
I'm going to make a statement and it sounds like mean, and I don't mean it to be mean because most people agree with me when I say it, but like doctors are so smart, right? Some of the smartest people on the planet, but they're also financially uneducated. And I feel like they really need a couple of years to understand what it means to have the income that they have, to have the repayment plan set up for their student loans. Like, I know people that have been making minimum payment on their student loans and now they owe more than what they did when they started out, like, because the interest rates and stuff like that are so high and they just don't know what they don't know and they're not paying it down. I feel like they almost need like a couple of years to truly understand what it means to have the money, to spend the money, to save the money, to invest the money before they're making these huge financial purchases. And I'm not saying you have to wait to buy the house, but maybe buy like a smaller house. I don't agree with live like a resident, but sometimes they just come out of the gate swinging and they're like, car, like max budget auto approval for a house, and I'm going to live in an expensive neighborhood and keep up with the Joneses, and kids are in private school, and now at the end of the month they have $0 left over because they you know, it's easy to spend money when you don't have the experience of saving.
I know, I agree with that as well. And I think, you know, like you said, I think uneducated and illiterate is, and not in like a bad way, right? It's nobody's fault.
No, I mean, they're 100% focused on their books and educating about the body and their practice. They don't have time to absorb other information. Like, I know that a lot of programs in med schools bring in professionals and lenders and advisors, and it's in one ear and out the other. Cause it's like, okay, cool. Like, I know you're talking to me, but I've got this test coming up and I've got all this information I'm trying to absorb. Like, I can't bring this in. And I mean, I'm an organization of physician spouses, and these doctors are getting all this information that would be great for us to know. Like, it would help about physician loans, about different like financing options. And that information is not getting brought home to us as the spouse or them as the spouse. So I feel like a lot of times the education piece ends up being mostly the burden of the physician spouse if they're married, if they have a partner that they're going through this with. So yeah, that's the other thing. Like, your physician, find someone who's financially savvy to run the household and run the business of your wealth management. That would be helpful.
Definitely. I think someone in the household has to quarterback the finances and, you know, just kind of the on who enjoys it, or if you want to delegate it to a capable team. And like I said, I don't think it's, I'm sure everyone on the podcast has heard me say this a billion times, but 3 of 4 American families say money is their number one household stress, right? And there's a lot of physicians that I'm sure you know that are working well into their 70s, maybe still living paycheck to paycheck. Like, it just kind of happens. So any advice that I would give too about kind of some of those like fundamentals, and I agree with everything you're saying about like, get used to your life, get used to your money in, your money out, set some goals together, like as a couple, and figure out like, how long do you want to work? When do you want your student loans gone? Are you going to qualify for PSLF? Like, do you want to buy a lake house? Do you want to, you know, what does all that look like? Overall, I think it's just like, you know, being here, being proactive, learning about like your money, and then mastering some of those fundamentals. How should doctors approach the rent versus buy decision, like when moving to a new city or starting a new attending role? Because I feel like so many people are like, I'm renting, I'm wasting money, like I'm not building equity. Sometimes I'm kind of like, well, you know, at the end of the day, like the bank kind of owns your house, you know, like essentially. So I guess, what are your thoughts on that, someone moving to a new city?
Again, depends on the timing of training and the market that you're in and the price point of homes and the type of market, you know, seller's market versus buyer's market and inventory availability. But I mean, like, rule of thumb for me here in St. Louis, again, like, we have an affordable market. So when residents are coming in, I'm like, if you're here less than 3 years, you should not be buying. If you're here for a fellowship, like, unless you're planning on renting it when you're done, which some of them are, they're like house hacking and buying a multifamily and renting out one side. And then when they leave, having, you know, two rentals out of one building. So like, that's a separate subject. That's not very many. That's only been like a couple out of almost 200 clients that I've worked with, you know, buying and selling in St. Louis. So the amount of time that you intend to be in that home definitely matters. 3 or less doesn't make any sense, especially when you're doing 100% finance loan. Like, people are like, what's the catch? What's the downside of a physician loan? And it's that you are 100% financing the house. And in the first few years, the majority of your payments is interest only. You're not really, you know, buying down that principal at all during those first few years. So say in 3 years, you need to sell, well, now you've got realtor fees and closing cost fees. You're already upside down 6% unless the equity has grown 6%. And so you really need to take into consideration, like, yes, this is 100% finance, but if I need to sell this right away, I'm going to be a little upside down because of the fees associated with selling the home. For an attending buying versus selling, again, the three-year marker, I would say, is still probably pretty applicable. Their tolerance for being able to handle if the market shifts and swings down. I mean, we're in a 2025 market right now, and a lot of cities have seen depreciation in value, but not a ton, but, you know, we had the extreme growth from 2020 until 23, a little bit of a pause in 24 in a lot of areas, and then 25, just it's dipped down a little bit. I think buyers are a little bit leery and nervous, and houses are priced high, and taxes have gone up, and insurance has gone up, and, you know, everything's gone up. And so, you know, a house 5 years ago costs a lot more now, not just an interest rate and price, but the taxes and insurance and stuff too. So just being having that market tolerance, if things do go upside down, like, and you have to bring cash to closing, if you have to sell, are you going to be able to handle that and deal with that? Because unfortunately, we don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict what the market's going to do. I'm hoping that in 2026, you know, we've already seen one rate slight decrease. And immediately after, a lot of lenders were saying that the rate of application increased significantly. So we do have more buyers coming back into the market, which is indicative of getting back into a seller's market where there's more buyers than listings. We're still on a listing deficit, so that really hasn't changed. We're just really short on buyers. But if we see those interest rates come down again a lot, like, yes, that makes it motivating to buy. Like, oh, I can afford more house now because the interest rates are lower. I'm like, okay, yeah, but so can everybody else. So now you're competing against everyone. So I kind of got side quested there, but I just think that it's their tolerance for understanding, like, worst case scenario, if you need to sell in the next few years, or how risk tolerant are you?
Mm-hmm. And how can physicians figure out what they can really afford without sabotaging their savings, student loans, or lifestyle goals? Because like you said many times, like, the physician will qualify for $1 million mortgage. So they go buy the million dollar house. And it's not, you know, not anybody's fault. They don't know. But what would be your advice, and how can they truly figure out what they can afford?
I mean, I think that it's worth having an advisor and a financial consultant in their corner. Like you said, like, you need to see, like, what's my goal for 20 years? How much do I want to spend on vacationing every year? Do I want to pay for private school? Like, how much do I need to budget and allocate in every month for my expenses and my needs and my future? And then what's left over? And out of that, how much am I comfortable spending on my mortgage? I think that you have to work backwards to understand. Some people do it the opposite. They're like, okay, I'm going to buy this house and my monthly payment's $10,000. And now whatever is left over, let's figure it out. And that's mm-hmm. when you end up with $0 at the end of the month because you overspent on the home. I think you have to have a plan with an advisor for the future, and then work your way backwards, and then figure out of the leftover, like, what am I willing to spend on the house every month?
I totally agree. And I would say to break it down a little further of, like, what that plan might look like, or, like, what we would do with a client, kind of figure out, like, what are your present life cash flows, right? Like, how much do you have? Like, how much is hitting your bank account every single month? How much is, like, the gross amount as well? How much on average are you spending every single month? Like, how much do you have left over? And then also thinking about, yeah, like, the future, what are your future goals, and what is it going to cost you to hit those goals? Let's say, like, retire, you know, reducing capacity at 50 and then full retirement at 65, paying off your student loans in 5 years with a private refinance, sending your kids to college and buying your dream, like, lake house or something like that. Maybe that costs you 10 grand a month. Then you kind of know, like, what can go towards future goals, and, like, does your new mortgage, and does that kind of, like, fit into that equation, or is it going to, like, derail some of your future goals? Then you kind of make, like, a decision. So hopefully that helps too. That's kind of, like, how we would probably approach it. And we'd be in conversation with you, the mortgage banker, and everybody, and kind of, like, work collectively as, like, a team to figure out what makes the most sense. Is that kind of what you were referring to, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Cool. So I'm thinking about, like, for maybe no one that's bought a house yet, and we don't need to go, like, into every single detail, because I know there's a billion things that go into real estate. Yeah. If someone wants to buy a house, and we can talk about the sell side of this too, what would be your advice, like, super simple, maybe 3 to 5 steps, kind of like the real estate 101 process, whether it's, like, get pre-qualified, because I feel like a lot of people, they get on Zillow and they find stuff they love, they tour it, and they're not pre-qualified, and then someone, you know, bids, they don't get it, and they're sad. So what would be your recommendation for kind of that process?
Yeah. I mean, you can go ahead and get pre-approved first. Just because of how I educate my clients, I would recommend getting in contact with a realtor first, especially if it's a realtor that you know has worked with a lot of physicians and may know the realm of physician loans and lenders really well, just because they will hopefully be able to connect you not only to, you know, maybe a national lender, but a local lender, like I mentioned earlier, that has some really good rates. You can try to Google that and shop for it on your own. But if you Google physician loans, like every bank is going to pop up, and whoever's got the best SEO and paid the most on Google ads, you know, it's not necessarily the one that actually has the best product. First two steps is connecting with the realtors and then connecting with the lenders. And yeah, on the searches, I cast a broad net and then tailor it down as we go, because you don't know what you want. Usually they know what they don't want, but they don't necessarily know what they want. And sometimes they jump in way too fast and they're like, the first one they see is the first one they get. And typically whenever we do it that quickly, they realize very quickly after purchasing the home that it was like a rash, knee-jerk reaction and decision. So I think it's just a process that needs to take its time, and you need to lean into and be educated throughout the process so that you're making like a savvy decision. And I know that's hard because it's a multiple offer situation. You know, you get that anxiety. It's like, everybody's offering on it. Like, I want to offer too. And now you're like overbidding and like waiving inspections and waiving appraisal and like waiving your financing contingencies and all these protection periods. I think that it's really important for you to understand what your contracts in your areas look like. Like, what are all of your layers of protection? What are the timelines for all of those things? What are the expenses that you're going to have on the front side? I go through like a very thorough buyer consultation. No matter if my buyers have bought with me before, if they've bought in the last year, I go over the residential sales contract nearly line by line, talking about everything so that they don't have to be experts, but like earnest money and the contingencies and timelines and all of the different facets and processes that they're going to be going through the contractual process. So that way, one, when it comes time to writing an offer, I'm like, okay, like, what do you want for this date and this price and the earnest money and the inspections? Like, how do we want to approach this? Because there's a strong way to write the offer and there's a safe way to write the offer. And I go through those variations. So when it is time to write offers in that way, my clients feel a lot more empowered and educated to be like, oh yeah, we don't want to waive inspections, but we're not going to negotiate an individual thing over $5,000. It makes it stronger, but still keeps protection for us. And I love that my clients can get to the point where they can tell me these things because they're knowledgeable enough about the process and have enough confidence to be able to say what they want out of it.
For anyone listening right now, Zoe, as we mentioned, owns an awesome company, nationwide company of what, 83 realtors, is it? And they're all married to physicians. Moving Medicine Partners, is it .com, I think. That might be a great place to get started if you're thinking about buying. Or you guys represent the sell side too, is that correct?
Yeah, we'll do. Yeah, we represent both sides, buy and sell. Because I mean, like selling is the amount of like physician clients that I had that sold this year and was relocating across the United States. So when they're selling, they're not here at all. Like, so I'm helping maintain the home when they're gone and, you know, the transaction, which is so common for our physician clients when they're moving. So yeah, both sides, we specialize in assisting with the physician family needs.
I think that's just a really unique company and like what a great way for trust and credibility right out of the gate. Every single one of your realtors is married to a physician. That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
Would the sell side look different, would you say? Like, do we want to get into the sell side too much, or do you think the buy side is a little more valuable?
The only thing that's different, I would say, about my physician clients with my traditional clients on the sell side is like most of my physician clients are relocating away. I have some physician clients that are just like upgrading or downgrading. Actually, a lot of my physician clients are wanting smaller homes, like they're over the McMansion maintenance and they want smaller lifestyles. So they maybe bought too big and they're wanting to downsize now. So for my local relocations, if it's a single physician, he's busy. So they just need a lot of hand holding. And I end up carrying a lot of weight because they're just busy and not home. When they're relocating away as a family, same thing. Like there's just a lot of weight to carry on physician transactions on the sell side because they're just not here. And I feel like once they're gone and they've started their new position, their brain isn't in it either. They're like, they walked away. The house is here. Sell it for me. I'll sign something whenever it's ready. And they're just checked out because they've already had to like focus all of their mental energy on the next thing. So, I mean, like logistically, is it the same? Yes. But I feel like the responsibility is a lot greater just because there's a lot more that we have to pick up for them.
I see. That makes sense. And a lot of what we talk about too, like, you know, we talk a lot about like behavioral money, behavioral finance, because like, of course, there's the math, but a lot of times like just talking about money is hard. Like Steph and I argued about money this week, and I do this for a living, right? Like money is like, well, right? So what, like, I guess, you know, if a physician family right now is thinking about buying or selling, like maybe what are some like questions they can be thinking about? Of like knowing where they should be living, like, you know, based on maybe like location, school system, like what are maybe just some like thoughts that can kind of get the wheels in their head to kind of, you know, because if he wants something, she wants something else, or he and he or whatever it is, like sometimes I'm sure that like caused some arguments in the household. So I guess maybe what are some like thought, like advice or like thought provoking questions that might kind of get people on the same page that you might ask?
Yeah, it's always frustrating whenever you do have like a married couple and one wants urban and one wants the suburbs. And I'm like, okay, like who wins this battle? Cause those are different things. I find like the physician is typically caring more about commute as their priority, and the spouse, and I'm not generalizing like female spouse, male physician, I just mean in general. And then the spouse, if they're at home more or whatever, like typically cares more about community and neighborhoods, amenities for kids and lifestyle. So I always do like a buyer intake, like a Google form where I have them fill it out together. I'm like, okay, like what are your non-negotiables? What are your absolute must-haves? Not just in the home, but in the neighborhood. And people relocating that have never been to St. Louis before. I'm like, what are your vibes? Like, do you like more urban? Do you like more like downtown cozy feel? Do you want everyone to be waving at the stop signs and like whatever? Or do you just want to like, you know, beeline to work and not have to wave at your neighbors and stuff like that? So I think that in all cities and all areas, there's different vibes to different areas, and being able to pinpoint what is the priority, like who takes precedence in the decision making, and then what are the priorities that you're trying to find in these homes, helps us narrow down exactly, because sometimes you don't even know what you want until these conversations and questions get sparked. And then you realize like, oh, I need a super quiet backyard, or like being close to the highway is a priority because the commute and getting on a highway is like super easy. And I don't want to have to think about getting through town to get to the highway to get to work. And then like even here in St. Louis, it's so funny because people are like, oh, I'm going to be working at BJC. I want like a 20-minute commute. I'm like, okay, does that include the 10-minute walk from the parking garage? Because the parking garage at BJC is a nightmare to get into the facility in the hospital. And so like, are we adding that to your commute, or like, is that in addition to? Again, the questions that they don't know, if they don't know, and your realtor doesn't know unless they know and they've been working in this world.
I love the approach you take, and even like having that intake form. I'd have to imagine a good majority of realtors are not doing that, or realtors that are kind of like, it's their side hustle. Like just being really intentional and asking yourself those like hard questions, like the non-negotiables, like what's most important to you? How are we going to make a final decision collectively? Sometimes, I mean, clients joke with me that it sometimes feels like marriage therapy, right? I'm sure you might get
it is. Vibe. Well, you know, the amount of clients that I have that I'm like, okay, like this person's staying at home with the kids and not working. Like, I know that you want a lot of input in the home because like maybe this person's bringing home the money, so they want to have what they want. I'm like, but this person's home all day long. So like really and truly, like I think that their comfort may outweigh your desires. Can we agree on that? And then they're like, all right, yeah, that's probably, you know, not to take away from like their needs and wants, but if there is some kind of like flip of a coin of like who's winning this argument, sometimes it is like very psychologically strategic and like how I approach them to try to figure out like what is the priority. And it's not like I'm making the decision, like I know what's going to be best for them, but just historically speaking, from all of the families that I've worked with, and who ends up happy and who ends up regretting their purchases, I can share that insight and be like, you know, from my experience, like they made this choice and didn't necessarily like love it because of the community wasn't there, or it was very isolating for the one that's at home all the time versus this one that's like near a park and play groups and all these things that was like a little bit more community driven, and they felt more connected and they seemed to be a lot happier with their decision. And once they hear that, they're like, oh, that makes sense. I'll even connect them. I'll be like, if you want to talk to this physician family that's done this, that lives here, that's experienced it, so that you can hear firsthand about this neighborhood, like I can get someone on the phone real quick because I've got clients that live all over this darn town, you know?
And sometimes you have to meet your partner like where they are, you know, and sometimes they're going to meet you, and sometimes you guys meet in the middle. That's just kind of, you know, the way the world goes in life, and everything with money and finance can definitely be, in real estate can be really hard.
Yeah. So sometimes a little bit of sacrifice from everyone is necessary.
No doubt about it. Moving now into a little bit on market outlook like heading into the future? And I know we don't have a crystal ball. What is kind of like your thought process? I know you talked about it a little bit earlier, just like market outlook heading as we head into 2026, both nationally and maybe in physician heavy areas. If it's hard to give an answer, I get it. We don't have to spend a ton of time.
We're still low on inventory, but inventory is sitting a lot longer than it has historically in most areas. I will say conditionally, if homes are in good condition and they're priced decently in a good neighborhood, regardless of the market, they're still selling. I think buyers are being a little bit more picky on location, which is smart. They should have been pickier on location, even when we were the height of craziness with 2.2% interest rates. The condition they're being a lot pickier on, which I don't necessarily agree with 100%. I think that if you find a good house, a good neighborhood, and it's priced well, like lean into the condition. Like if you can change the floors and make the home what you want it to be and not have to spend $100,000 more competing for the Pinterest perfect home, again, like I said, please consider that. Like please financially, it could be so wise of you to consider that. I hope interest rates come down. If they do, the spring is going to be bananas again though. Right now in October of 2025, I think that it is an ideal time to buy. Markets are slow historically in the fall after school starts. The market is slower right now because the interest rate kind of being in this gray, like, are they going to lower? People kind of waiting to see if they come down more. So buyers are being a little bit more hesitant and slow in their decision making. I feel like everyone that's like, oh, I'm just going to wait for the rates to come down a little bit more and the spring to come, more inventory. You and everybody else, buddy, like we are in such a deficit of buyers with so much pent up demand. When that gate opens, it's going to be a flood and it's going to be bidding wars and chaos again. This is just my analysis of what I predict to happen.
So it sounds like be proactive potentially right now if you're thinking about it and be wise.
Yeah.
I was going to ask like the top moves they should consider in the next 12 to 18 months, but that might have answered the question.
Yeah. Yeah. I bought last October because I just know historically October is when you can purchase a home the most affordably. Statistically across the decades, you can always see a little dip in sales price in October. If you're selling, you may want to wait a little bit until like right after Christmas, just because usually right after Christmas in January, purchase prices start creeping up a little bit more. And then spring like is the highest peak of when you get the most equity out of your home. A lot of people still have to sell though, you know, deaths, degrees, divorce, different things like cause people to have to sell. So October, typically people that are selling have to. It's not a want to, it's a have to situation. So you can negotiate a little bit more and maybe get a better price.
Interesting. Okay. And are you seeing anybody like with rates coming down a little bit? We've seen some positions who have been able to refinance their student loans and get like best rates we've seen probably in 3 years. Are you seeing any of that in real estate? Not quite yet.
Yeah, mortgages like probably 0.25%, something like that. Nothing like life changing. We're still like in the high fives to mid sixes, depending on what product you're getting and what your credit score is. So they've dropped a little bit. I think they were like sevens last year or something. So they've come down at mid, but I don't think we'll ever see twos again. That was crazy. I don't even think that we'll see threes. We might see fours. I think that we should probably land in the fives, hopefully next year. And that's kind of like where status quo like leads us for a while, but we'll see.
Okay. And for listeners right now, I'm all about action. I meant to do this a couple minutes ago, so you can take a drink of water or something. If you've been with us so far, like take out a pen, piece of paper, notes app, tell Siri to remind you, whatever you got to do. And like, what's 1 to 3 things that you could act on in the next 24 hours to bring something that Zoe and I have talked about together so far to life? I'm all about action. So you can listen to as many podcasts as you want. If you don't act on it, like nothing will happen. So what's something that you can do? Maybe it's with the offering in the house that you've been waiting on and you're waiting for rates to come down. Maybe that's it. I'm not a direct recommendation, but just a potential thought.
Yeah.
So this will be a really fun topic next. I see a lot of physicians and just humans in general get sold on the idea that like real estate creates passive income and they're just going to like buy a bunch of houses and rent them out and there's going to be no work involved. They don't need to go repair the toilets and the furnace. And I always tell people it's probably like if you want to be really successful with having like passive residual income, probably going to be almost equivalent to like growing a business for like 10, 15, 20 years. I'd be curious to hear like your thoughts on that. What's your honest take on that narrative?
I believe in real estate investment to build wealth. Absolutely. Because of the passive income, which I mean, the expectation right now to have passive income on something you purchase is low. Like, mortgage rates and your monthly payment are typically higher than what rental rates are in most neighborhoods, just because the interest rate and the insurance and the taxes have gone up and rents haven't climbed to meet that just yet. I just purchased a home. I closed on it 2 weeks ago. I got divorced last year and I had to sell off all of my real estate assets. I had two long-term rentals and a short-term rental that I had to sell to divide assets. And so now I'm rebuilding that strategy, but my goal is to buy one house a year and I'm going to long-term rent it, because short-term rentals was just a lot of work for me running other full-time businesses that I own and operate. And it's not about what I'm making monthly. I actually have to put about $100 into that house a month for it to break even. And I do have to go over and have a handyman if something, you know, toilet breaks or whatever, that is something that I have to be on call to be able to manage. So I bought it near my home so that it was within driving distance for me to make some repairs if necessary. But what I'm able to do, and this is kind of like next level investing, is bonus depreciate my asset. So to leverage what I purchased against what I'm being taxed on at the end of the year. So I already did a cost segregation study. I qualify with real estate professional status and I can offset my taxes by about $70,000 this year, which is huge for me. So for anybody listening, if you have a spouse that isn't working full time, I think real estate investing is extraordinarily wise because of the tax benefit and the hopeful appreciation and equity. But that's a long-term goal. Like, I don't expect to have so much equity in this house that I purchased and make so much money off of the rent that I'm going to be able to retire on the rental income. Like, that's just not going to happen. And after I have 5 or 10 of these, I'm not even going to manage them myself. I'll hire a company to manage them at that point for the monthly rent rates, renewing leases, all the repairs and maintenance and stuff like that. Once I get to a certain point, somebody else will take care of that. But like I said, the amount of money that I'm saving on what I'd be paying in taxes by buying a house every year, for me, is the true benefit in real estate investing. Not just like buy a house, maybe make a couple $100 in profit in month and rental. That's just, for me, I don't think that that's where the leverage and the wealth is right now.
And not to anybody's fault, I just feel like you see so much stuff on the internet about like residual income, passive income. And I think you can do it, but it's going to require work and require taking some risk, like all the things.
My parents were business owners growing up, and I got to see them firsthand, like, struggle with making money some years and not others. But what ultimately built their wealth was they made some crazy decisions and buying some land in my hometown. They bought the closed abandoned hospital and they were able to leverage this land and build a bank and build a hotel. But they put equal, if not more, work into developing and investing into that land to create something out of it as they were in the companies that they own. My dad was an HVAC contractor and my mom owned a pool and spa store. It was work. It was a full-time job to buy that land, hold it long enough that the value was there, and then help in building the hotel and the bank. And it created a ton of wealth for them, but it was a very risky and long-term plan and a lot of work.
That's a really like cool story. I love to hear success stories like that. But once every successful business owner looks like an overnight success, especially with like media and everything, right? So a lot went into, I love the first world stories you're telling about yourself, parents. I think it's really super, or really helpful for everybody. Real quick, the bonus appreciation thing. Can anybody do that? Or do you qualify for, because you're a realtor?
You have to qualify for real estate professional status. So you can't be working full-time and qualify for it. So it's not like a physician that's working full-time as a doctor can buy a house and then qualify for REPS status by managing this rental and then be able to bonus depreciate it by doing a cost segregation study, whatever. You have to have someone that's working. Usually you have to have someone that's working part-time and then the hours allocated towards maintaining, updating, getting leases, managing the rental or whatever have to be equal to or greater than like the amount of hours that you're working. You don't quote me on that because it's changed a little bit. And then I know that it's different too if you're doing long-term versus short-term. If you're managing a short-term rental, the requirements are less restrictive. So like you can qualify for REPS status a lot more easily. REPS is real estate professional status. Okay. Just so that you guys understand what I'm saying. I would Google that and say like, what are the current qualifications for real estate professional status if I were to buy a long-term rental versus short-term rental, and just see like if you have a significant, like a spouse that's at home with the kids that would want to invest a little bit of time, it could save a ton of money on your tax life. I mean, like if you're saving $50,000, $60,000 on tax in a year, you know, she may not be making $50,000 or $60,000, but by saving that, whoever it is, basically did. So it's something that could be saving a ton of money for the family by pursuing that.
Yeah, it sounds like talk to your tax team, and if your tax
yeah for sure
no idea about it, maybe try to find a new tax advisor.
And that is
and
true too.
Of course, it's tax advice. You know, disclaimer.
No. There are CPAs that specialize with real estate stuff, because I've talked to CPAs that they're like, you don't qualify for RIP status. And I'm like, okay, you don't know me, sir. And you don't know this stuff. So like, I unfortunately can't work with you because real estate is such a significant part of my strategy. And if they don't know that, then I can't work with them. I need someone that's up to date on, you know, prior to our current administration. The previous administration had decreased how much you could claim on the depreciation. So I think it was down to 60% or 40%. Now we're back to 100%, meaning I can claim a lot more in loss in 1 year this year than I could last year. So yeah, saving a lot more money.
Oh, that's really interesting. And that's a unique strategy. And once again, you know, if that's something you guys are interested in, I would go talk to a tax team or find a tax team to see if it's realistic for you. I think at the end of the day too, it just boils down to, and I think there's great people that have done extremely well in real estate, people that have done really well in just traditional investing, people that have done well in both. Yeah. You kind of have to decide, like, what do you want to do? Like, do you want to buy a house and manage it, or find a team to manage, you know, all the things to put the work there, or do you want to go like a different path? How can a physician tell they're ready to invest in real estate as like a real estate investment? Do you have any like thoughts on that, or like rules of thumb, or is it just kind of dependent on what they're looking for?
I think it just depends on the timing and what they're looking for. I think typically when people start investing more in real estate, they've already kind of like, they got their 401k, like they've got like some investments and some stocks and some traditional funds, and they're maxing out their Roth, and they're just like, I don't know, like I feel like oftentimes they're like, well, I've got this extra money, like what's a creative thing that I can do with it? I think white coat investor, and you like, you know, there's different professionals out there that are kind of like pushing physicians to go outside of their comfort zone to pursue alternate investing that's a little bit more involved. I think that it's actually really good for doctors that are getting close to burnout to find this hobby that has positive outcomes typically that they can invest some like mental energy into, so that it's not just like physicianing all the time and the burden that comes with that and the mental heavy load. So I think that a lot of doctors are investing in real estate now just because it's an exciting, I don't want to call it side hustle, but it kind of is for it to an extent. That's allowing them to pursue success in a different way. And it's giving them a little bit of their mental health back.
Definitely. I think there's a lot of different outlets to do that, right? Like it could.
Yeah.
It could
gosh, absolutely. Yeah. I know something like I do woodworking, and they make beer, and that's their super fun hobby that kind of keeps them mentally sane whenever they're like off of a really heavy call schedule.
My last guest on the show, Dr. Sarah Saman, runs a physician coaching company. Would probably be a good connection for you too. But she was a cardiologist, and she always took one afternoon off a week to ride horses and do equestrian. She gave up a ton of money throughout the course of her career. If you took that and put it in a finance calculator, probably lost out on even more money, but it was something that like filled her cup. So I think, yeah, like you said, whatever it is, but it makes sense too with like real estate, especially if someone enjoys it. I'm thinking right now, like our members, some would be like, I would have no joy in doing that. And someone would be like, I would love to do that as kind of like a side hustle. So moving on, this is one of my favorite segments of the show, the Your Health is Your Wealth segment. I learned before we started today that you used to run a CrossFit gym, which I had no idea about that. So I think this would be like a super fun segment for everybody. Just kind of like, our health is our most important thing. I know a lot of physicians, because you're selfless people, put your patients before yourselves, right? So this, I always like to incorporate this segment just to have like a little fun and maybe give some like cool little health tips for everybody. So you're running like a national business, multiple businesses, serving a bunch of clients, working with physicians, balancing family life with kids. What are some of your daily non-negotiables that keep you grounded and performing at a high level?
It's so funny. I was just talking about this yesterday, about the seasons of fitness that I go through. You know, I had my CrossFit phase, which I'm actually away from right now, just because like the amount of cortisol and adrenaline that like CrossFit brought out, I got enough fight or flight response that I live with on a daily basis. I really don't enjoy CrossFit anymore because it's just too intense and I don't enjoy it. And there's days that I don't like lifting because I just feel like I'm doing all the heavy lifting in my business all the time, and like lifting heavy things sometimes just feels like another burden that I'm having to pick up. So I'm kind of in this phase right now of like yoga and walking, which sounds kind of lame, but mentally, it's what I crave and what I need at this moment because I'm needing a little bit more peace in my life. And that is what's bringing me peace. I also do Bible studies and devotions every morning before my kids wake up. I try to have my cup of coffee and a little bit of Bible time before I jump into any work and before my kids wake up and start asking me for a million things. So those are like my two strategies at this phase in this moment in my life. But I love that every couple of years, you know, I may be in a phase where I am pushing harder and I am wanting to grow something. I do want to push past some mental barrier, and then it may go into like more of a heavy lifting, CrossFit, endurance running type of phase. But right now I'm just kind of like in this chill, passive, peaceful, not too like adrenaline dumping phase.
I think that's wise. Yoga is one of the best things I've ever done in my life, and walking as well. Yeah. Love both of those things. Yeah. What is it? You know, I know you mentioned like the daily devotions before the kids get up. I don't have kids either, so this might be some good advice for me. Like, what is your morning and maybe like your evening? Like, do you have a morning and evening routine when you're like functioning at your best, or is that not really important to you? Because I've heard both sides of it. Like, I've heard just wake up and work. And I've some people like, I need to ground myself. I can't just get out of bed and like go right to the computer.
Yeah, I will say from like 2017 until probably last year, the year before when I like was getting divorced, I worked until 11 p.m. And then some days I woke up at 4 a.m. and I started working again. And it was just a grind. I wanted to get my business off the ground. I needed this thing to be a success. I needed growth. And so like my capacity was work all the time, all day. It never shut off. It was what I needed to do in that stage to get it to where it is. But now I'm at this place where like I get 9 hours of sleep every night, sometimes more. I don't have an alarm clock in the morning. I wake up naturally, which is good because I usually wake up before the kids. But there are some days where I sleep in until 7:30 or 8. And it's like, okay, like I am trying to allow my body to get what it needs by getting to sleep at a decent time, not having one glass of wine every night. Like I maybe only like do that a couple nights a week now. And then I just get like really, really, really good sleep. I don't let things stress me out anymore either. In this business in real estate, there's a lot of conflict with the other side, conflict with things falling apart. And it used to kind of affect me like on a physiological level. And I've gotten to this phase where like I've been able to be more in tune with myself and recognize those physical symptoms and kind of shut them down quickly and stay in control of my body and my mind. And I think a lot of that is that yoga and that slowing down that I've experienced in the last couple of years of just being able to process things in a lot more healthy way, allowing my body the rest that it needs and allowing myself to have the successes when they come and put things on the back burner for when I'm ready to achieve them.
How did you make that transition? Because I feel like for physician listeners right now, like residency, fellowship, working 100-hour weeks, all of a sudden they're in attending and, you know, it's probably like, okay, what do I do with myself? Like I have, you know, how did you go from like brute force to slowing down? Was it forcing yourself to do yoga and walk and just be like, I'm sure it didn't happen overnight.
I just recognized like how much of a toll it was taking on my body physically. I was stressed out all the time. I was having like almost autoimmune type responses throughout my body that I was like, why am I so sick all the time? But it was because I was just chronically dumping adrenaline into my body. I wasn't listening to the warning signs of my body, feeling pains and reactions to situations around me. And I think once I got the first taste of like stepping back from some of that chaos, and I was like, wow, that was chaotic. Like, wow, that didn't feel good. And actually allowing myself to be in that moment to recognize how uncomfortable I'd been. But what was weird was like, even the quiet and the stillness is still uncomfortable. It's like not a familiar feeling. So actually allowing yourself to be uncomfortable in the stillness to recognize that that's actually normal and that's safe. And that's where my stasis should be, and trying to figure out how to keep it at that level. And I mean, I ebb and flow, like I still spiral into a little chaos ball every once in a while, but it's so much easier to come back down and recognize like, no, this feels so much better and safer. So yeah, physicians transitioning from that chaos of just like sleepless nights and endless calls and a lot of attending still transition into a position that is probably overburdening them still with their schedule, to which I say, get a really good contract attorney to negotiate your terms and your call schedule so that you're not on like nightly calls, to give yourself a break and then just like figure out that it's okay to be still for a moment. The medical school, residency, fellowship grind is a sprint, an endless sprint. And when you stop sprinting, it feels really weird. And you just got to learn how to be okay with that weirdness and realize that, like, no, this is where you want to be and this is where you need to be. So bring it back down when you get off work.
Quick shout out to Contract Diagnostics. I don't know if you've worked with them at all, but they do a great job in that space.
Yeah.
Yeah, contract review. John Apino is awesome. He's been on the show. And yeah, at first, it's really scary to sit with yourself. I think, and I'm not saying every listener needs to go do yoga, but I remember I did yoga because my body hurt after being like a collegiate athlete, mainly my low back. And I was like, all right, let's give this yoga thing a try. And all of a sudden, like a year or two later, I was like mentally like the best I ever was in my whole life. And I was like, you're doing like a moving meditation. So not that everyone needs to go meditate or do yoga, but you kind of like find that thing. Cause that was kind of my transition to go from like college athlete, starting a business to like force myself to be like an introvert and slow down. And it's definitely really scary. No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Yeah. This past year I had my kids half the time. And the other half of the time, I'm like, I kind of just want to sit at home by myself. Maybe I'm being too much of a recluse right now, but I'm enjoying my single girl era, single woman era. It's just like this quiet homebody that's found comfort in being alone and in the silence and the peace. And I'm sure I'll come out of my shell and
there's seasons of life.
There's seasons of life or whatever, but I'll say the first 6 months of being alone, being quiet, being still. And I'm like, this is weird. I need someone to talk to. I need something to do. I need to fill this void. I need to start a new business. I need to take care of the website. And it's like, no. And I don't even watch TV now. I just have music on. I journal a lot. Oh, I read a lot. That's like my like guilty pleasure is I read a lot, not like self-help books. Like I read stuff to like escape the world. So it's quiet definitely. Though. I like it that way.
Yeah, the little voice in your head will definitely let you know about it when you first try to slow down.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Over time, it'll get better.
Exactly.
So we all hit moments, and maybe this, you know, we kind of answered this already, but like when you're feeling burnt out, what do you do personally when you start to feel drained or overwhelmed? I know a lot of physicians, you know, 42% report burnout. So what are maybe just some little things you might do if you're feeling it?
I just focus on like what's necessary. You know, everybody's got their task and to-do list, and it's like, you know, you have your priority things and you have the things that you want to get done eventually. I just kind of like tear the eventual things off the list so I don't even see them. So they're not burdening my mind with the things I'm falling short on. I used to be this mindset of like succeed and endure and win and like crush and just like, you know, the entrepreneur mindset. And failure is not an option and I must win at all costs. And I'm like, you know what? If I fail today a little bit, that's okay. Like I'm going to serve the clients that I have actively because they're my priority. My kids are the focus of my life. And so like I make sure that they're attended to and my attention is on them fully. I give myself the peace and stillness and sleep and the brain rest that I need. And some of those tasks and things that are built, just realize that it's okay to let some of those things go. I know that spouses have like honey-do lists and if they're not getting done, they get frustrated with each other. But I think that just checking in with each other and being like, hey, I know you want to get this done, but like, I'm really stressed and overburdened. Can we like table this for a month or two? Having that recognition in each other, having that realization within yourself that it's okay. You can let some stuff go.
Definitely. I love that. Moving into lightning round. We're almost done. You've absolutely crushing this. I appreciate it. So I'll just ask you like a couple quick fire questions here. Mentioned you love reading. What's the best book you've read this year?
Oh gosh. So I'm reading this book right now. It's kind of like a side quest from the Harry Potter books. This woman that was called Lin Yu wrote this off script manuscript that you can only download in PDF because it's technically not legal, but it was called Manacled. And it was like this like love story between Hermione and Draco after everybody else had died and Voldemort win. It was like Voldemort won. It was like this like whole alternate reality dystopian of like how Harry Potter could have ended. But she did just come out with an actual published book called Alchemize that I'm in the middle of right now. So I'm super big Harry Potter nerdy fan. And that is like my guilty pleasure right now are these like alternative side quest dystopians of Harry Potter.
Listen to a podcast. I don't know if you know Jay Shetty, but he had Hermione. Oh, I'm picking on her name in real life.
Hermione. That's the only. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. But
anyways, it was a very interesting podcast. And she kind of talked about her
battle. She's brilliant.
with being like labeled as Hermione her whole life, and I just did it to her. So sorry, I really enjoyed that episode.
Sorry.
If you listen to it. I'm not a huge like Harry, never got super into it, but it's a very fascinating podcast for anyone that wants to listen to it.
Like my dog's name is Harry Potter. It's a thing. It's like a whole thing.
I love that. What's your like go-to yoga class style? Are you like a vinyasa, slow flow?
I've been trying to do more vinyasa. I definitely like love, I've had to like stop going to hot yoga because again, like I just can get too intense with things and I'm like, if you're not sweating, you're not working. So I've definitely gotten into more like vinyasa, like long holding, like 3 to 5 minute pose holds. And it's been so enjoyable. It's only been in the last 6 months to 8 months that I've been doing classes like that. And it's surprising how much I enjoy them. Like I'm not bored. The 5 minutes goes by so quickly and I'm like, oh, I'm not done here yet. And it's taken a while to get to the point where I've enjoyed holding poses for that long. But now it's a learned practice for sure. Otherwise, heck yeah, hot yoga. I'm like, I have a moat of sweat around me. I feel so bad. I sweat so much and I'm probably like swinging stuff on people around me. It's disgusting, but I love it.
Same. I can relate to everything. I go to like a hot yoga class. I'm like, this is going to be like an intense workout, but I've had to force myself to do like restorative yoga to like, and it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I agree.
Biggest real estate myth that you wish would die.
Oh, jeez. I don't know that date the rate, marry the house. Like, I don't know. I just think that's like stupid advice that every realtor says to try to convince people to buy in any market. Like, listen, it doesn't make sense for everyone all the time. Like, leave people alone.
What's your favorite St. Louis neighborhood for physician families?
Oh, that's too hard. It just depends. I love Kirkwood because they have the cutest downtown with like all these shops and restaurants. And I just love downtown Kirkwood. Ladue is like where every physician family wants to be because of the schools. And there's like some sprawling yards and some like, you know, bigger, older ranches or whatever, which is nice. Clayton is always like a to-do place with like a fun, more urban downtown that isn't as common in St. Louis. And then I really love Town and Country too, just the homes in Town and Country. Huge 1 acre lots with like, you know, big McMansions of sorts. Like it's just very like grand feeling.
And what's
I can't say one neighborhood. I love them all.
What's a dream home feature that you can't resist that you love?
I need a big closet. The closet does it for me anyway. It's so funny. I've had a couple of clients that like the closet was like the deal breaker or whatever. Now, dream features. I need a 3-car garage, a big closet, and then a functional kitchen. Those are the only three things I care about.
And finish a sentence. A life well lived is for you in this season.
A life at peace. Yeah. As one at peace.
I love it. Where can everybody find you? I know we mentioned your website, but you know, share with everybody where they can find you, if they want to work with you, work with your team. I know you have realtors all across the country. Where can they find you?
Yeah. So if you want to find a real estate agent anywhere in the US, you can go to the website movingmedicinepartners.com and fill out a request form there and we'll get you connected with someone. If we don't have a physician spouse in that area, we'll actually vet realtors in that area, either through previous physician purchasers and physician spouses there. So we've got a network of about 20,000 physician spouses and some Facebook groups. So we're pretty adept at getting connected with people and communities that can serve you. So that's where you would go to find a physician. If you just want to chat with me, I'm on Instagram, ZoeSTLRealtor, or my email address is zoe.taylor@compass.com. So lots of ways to reach me. I love helping people, like consulting with decision making of investment properties, with relocating, with lots of different aspects of life. So we'd love to connect.
Thank you so very much. Grateful for you. You are a wealth of knowledge. You're also really intentional at the same time with your approach and wanting to do good things for people. So this was awesome.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And thanks so much for being here. And listeners, write down your top 1 to 3 action items and make sure you do something in the next 24 hours or tell Siri to remind you tomorrow. Good one, everybody.
Thank you, James.
As we wrap up, just a friendly note. The information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and isn't tailored to your specific situation. IAmWealth does not offer individual financial advice outside of a formal fiduciary consulting agreement. Content discussed in the A Life Well Lived podcast is not and does not represent any financial, tax, and or legal advice. The intent of the A Life Well Lived, a Physician's Guide to Wealth podcast, is to provide extremely valuable educational content for free. For personal questions, we hope you'll visit us at iamwealth.com to see how we can help you and your family take control of your money. And just remember, everyone's finances are different. There is no one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter solution to money. If there all was, we'd be rich and happy, just like there isn't one-size-fits-all diet or we'd all have six-pack abs, right? So be sure to work with someone who gets the full picture of your goals and challenges, or visit iamwealth.com to learn more about how we can help you today. And thank you, my friend, for letting me be a part of your journey and story, and I will see you next time.